2. Independent Indonesia. A New Life for Francisca. In 1951, Francisca came back to her home country. At 24 years old, she and her new husband moved into what was basically a garage at the Air Force Airport, 10 miles outside the center of town. This was much rougher than what she was used to, but they had a cousin who hooked them up with the space, and they took it. Every day, she woke up at 6 in the morning, rode her bicycle to the nearest station, caught a bus, then jumped on the back of a little 6-seater car with a motorcycle engine, and rode into work. There was only a little bit of traffic in those days, and almost no Muslim women covered up in hijab, but with heavy humidity and temperatures around 90 degrees almost every day of the year, commuting in Jakarta has always been a sweaty, difficult affair. She didn't mind any of this one bit. Francisca, like so many other Indonesians, was overcome with excitement. After hundreds of years of exploitation and slavery, she had her own country, and it was just 1 year old. As she made her way across town every day, she didn't think about the comfortable life she had given up. The only thing she cared about was that she was building up Indonesia from nothing. "We have to live life to the utmost to do everything we can," she thought. "When you're working toward a cause like this, one that's so much bigger than you, it hardly feels like work at all." Francisca Patipilohi was born in 1926, and she was technically royalty. Indonesia has often been governed by numerous small kingdoms and some large kingdoms, and her family were members of the upper class on Ambon, a quiet and comfortable little island surrounded by white sand and bright blue ocean, 1,500 miles northeast of Jakarta. Those aristocracies were often granted special privileges within the Dutch colonial structure, but her father chose to forego them and make his life as an architect in the capital, which was then called Batavia. The larger island of Java is one of the world's most densely populated pieces of land, with a dazzling constellation of cities, many of which are thousands of years old, but Batavia was never an important city for any of its local kingdoms. It was an outpost of the major pepper port of Banten when the Dutch East India Company, one of the most important organizations in the development of both global capitalism and colonialism, took over in 1619. The megacity that exists now was largely a Dutch construction, and it still feels different from the rest of Java. Francisca's father thrived as an architect and was able to afford a nice home in the city. He did so well, in fact, that Francisca was able to attend colonial school with Dutch children. At home, she loved to spend time in her father's library, reading the children's books he had bought for her. She was the only little girl in the family, so she was alone in the house a lot. Almost all the children's stories then were in Dutch, telling tales of white children back in Holland or Germany. She dove so deeply into Grimm's fairy tales, books about cowboys and Indians, and Hans Christian Andersen that she truly believed they referred to her own country. She thought that the Rhine flowed through some part of Indonesia until she was a teenager, but she read nothing about other Indonesians. At home, she would speak both the colonial language, Dutch, and some of the tongue her family had brought from Ambon. Her family was Protestant, as plenty of Indonesians in the outer islands are, and she studied at a private Christian school nearby. She was intensely smart and fiercely curious. When she spoke about the fun of learning something new, the pitch of her voice would always rise with excitement. She also learned very quickly what it meant to be a brown girl in a colony run by white people. There were only 5 native students in her class, and the hierarchy of status was obvious. But it was outside school one Sunday that the brutal reality of her condition was driven home. It was especially hot. She went along with a friend from school and her Dutch family to the local pool to spend the day swimming. As they handed their tickets to the man at the gate, he stopped her. Indonesians were not allowed. Her relative wealth didn't matter, nor did the fact that the other girls protested. She was a native. In 1942, when she was just 16, the Japanese arrived. Under Emperor Hirohito, the Japanese had become an aggressive imperialist power allied with the Nazis and were sweeping through much of Southeast Asia, setting up occupation governments. At first, some Indonesians welcomed them, including the leaders of the country's small independence movement, which had been bubbling up for decades. At least the Japanese were Asians, the thinking went. Their victory had proved whites were not invincible, and they might treat locals better than the Dutch had. The day after their invasion, Francisca's father came home and announced to the family, "They are our liberators." But young Francisca saw, before most of the country, that this was an illusion. Just days later, the family was going for a walk in their quiet, leafy neighborhood called Menteng when a Japanese guard nearby started screaming at her father. He, of course, didn't understand Japanese, and he didn't know he was supposed to bow, so he didn't. The guard came up to him and struck him hard on the face in front of his whole family. "After that, we hated the Japanese," Francisco would say later. "We knew their true purpose." Others got it much worse. By the thousands, Indonesian women were forced into sexual slavery, made to work as comfort women for the occupying Japanese troops. The Dutch were put into concentration camps. Francisca was put into a different school. The new school was a bit of a shock for two reasons. First, she was considered equal to the other students. Second, she learned to speak Bahasa Indonesia, which means the Indonesian language, a version of Malay that is now Indonesia's official tongue. Francisca had always excelled at language, but here she was starting from zero. She wasn't alone, though. Only a small minority of Indonesians spoke it as their first language. It had been used as a lingua franca at ports and in trade for a while, but most people spread across the country's 13,000 wildly diverse islands didn't know it. Soon after the Japanese left in 1945, a man named Sukarno declared independence very close to Francisca's house. He had been hesitant to do it, so three youth leaders in the independence movement, impatient with his decision, kidnapped him and fellow independence leader Hatta. This was considered a brusque but broadly acceptable way of forcing someone's hand at the time, until Sukarno committed to proclaiming the creation of independent Indonesia. Maybe he was right to be a bit worried. Not long after the speech, Sukarno's independence movement was in trouble. Just as the French did in Indochina, the Dutch came back, attempting to reassert colonial rule. The Netherlands called the attempts at reconquest police actions, in terminology that managed to be both condescending and euphemistic, and they were brutal. As the Japanese had, the Dutch employed mass violence to suppress support for the new republic. The independence leaders, a mix of nationalists, leftists, and Islamic groups, hopped around the archipelago, making alliances with local kingdoms and mounting resistance. In the middle of all this, in 1947, Francisca went to Holland to study in the small university town of Leiden. She attended the Royal Institute of Eastern Countries, set up to study European colonial possessions. Right away, she got involved in the Indonesian student organization, as almost everyone did. And right away, she met a man named Zane, 5 years her senior. She didn't like him at first. She had considered herself some kind of a feminist from an early age and had no intention of marrying, ever. She had seen that even the smartest, best-educated women in the Dutch East Indies never got to put to use all the wonderful things that they had learned once they got married. She wanted to work. Zane was handsome, sure, even gallant, but he was a little too self-assured, maybe a little too bossy when he asked her to take the role of treasurer within the student organization. She wasn't going to let anyone think she was impressed with him, like so many other girls were. So at first, a bit coyly, she rejected his advances. But then she got to know him. They'd spend hours and hours talking about history and the anti-colonial struggle and the ways her childhood had been unjust, twisted by European domination. How they could fight to make things right. This was exciting. He was exciting. She was willing to admit that. They began working together tirelessly, united by a common cause. That cause, of course, was independence. Somewhat ironically, direct contact with Europe had always been important for fomenting revolutionary movements in the Third World. The Indonesian independence movement had early roots in Holland, and it was in Paris that Ho Chi Minh got his political education. When studying or working back in the imperial capitals, colonial subjects often came into contact with ideas that were never allowed to reach their territories. Much of colonialism had relied on the logic of do as I say, not as I do, or in practice, do as whites say, not as white do. So while Europeans themselves were extending education to their entire populations, and their intellectuals were debating the merits of socialism and Marxism, Much of this was banned in the colonies. The natives might get ideas. For example, in the Congo, brutally controlled by the Belgians since King Leopold II established the Free Congo State in 1885, and the United States rushed to be the first country in the world to recognize the colony, authorities banned left-leaning publications and liberal lifestyle magazines that circulated freely back in Europe and were scared even by the fact that working-class blacks lived together in urban areas. Wouldn't this lead to subversion, or worse, Bolshevism? Congolese pupils learned about the Belgian royal family, but not the American civil rights movement, and the French Revolution was explained very carefully so as not to make that whole affair seem too attractive in African editions of textbooks. The justification given by European authorities in the Congo went like this. All those in our colony are unanimous in stating that the blacks are still children, both intellectually and morally. For Francisca and Zane, who began dating in earnest in the late 1940s, the colonial independence struggle was intimately tied to left-wing politics. So she, a wholehearted supporter of Indonesian freedom, fell naturally into socialist circles, as the two struggles had long been married together. In the 1930s and 1940s, practically no Europeans supported colonial independence except the leftists. The Indonesian Communist Party, the Partai Komunis Indonesia, PKI, was founded in 1914 as the Indies Social Democratic Association with the help of Dutch leftists, worked alongside Sukarno and pro-independence Muslim groups in the 1920s, and then engaged in active anti-fascist work during the Japanese occupation. Francisca heard a little bit about socialism at the student meetings, and she liked what she heard, but she didn't get too involved in any of the more intricate ideological battles. She didn't take part in debates over the so-called Madian affair and the clashes between communists and Sukarno's Republican forces within the revolutionary movement. It was much easier to take sides when the Netherlands launched a second attempt to reconquer Indonesia. In protest, all the students with Dutch scholarships returned them, and Francisca joined them in walking out of their classes. Then, that same year, she jumped at the opportunity to attend the Second World Festival of Youth and Students in Budapest. It was organized by the World Federation of Democratic Youth. She knew, of course, that democratic in this usage basically meant socialist, and that Hungary was allied with the Soviet Union, but none of that made the prospect of the journey any less exciting. Not all of the Indonesian students could afford to attend, but she had the money for a ticket, so she jumped on the train and crossed what the Americans were now calling the Iron Curtain. She didn't see one. For her, the trip was a wonder, and she stared out the windows as post-war Germany, then Austria and Hungary, flew by. Europe was in tatters, but still, Budapest was enchanting. And there, no one treated her like a second-class citizen, like they did in her home country. But nothing prepared her for the youth festival itself. She met left-wing students from all over the world, from nations across Asia, from Africa, and even from the United States. This was a real shock to her, as she'd really only seen Americans in the movies. She began talking to the students from the U.S. and was even more shocked to see a black man and a white woman together. She didn't know much about international politics, but she knew all about the racism back in the United States. So she asked them, "How did you come here together? Isn't it difficult for you? Don't they keep you apart?" They chuckled and nodded. "Well, yes, but we manage," the American woman said. Next, she met students from Korea and the Congo. Among the Congolese delegation, she swears she met a charming young man by the name of Lumumba, but she didn't know much else about him at the time. The students put on dances and cultural performances from all over the world. They were a display of international unity, as well as the pride that each nation felt. When she described this show afterward, her voice got so high it practically became a whistle. In 1950, she and Zane eloped. They had to sneak off to Prague to get married, because Dutch authorities would have required her to get her father's permission, and he was still withholding it for some reason or another. They didn't care much why. The trip was another little adventure, and they got to put their language skills to use because their humble ceremony had to be in German. No problem. By that time, Zane knew English, Indonesian, Dutch, and Batak, the language native to his family on the island of Sumatra, and Francisca was now fluent in German, French, Indonesian, Dutch, and English, on top of a bit of Bahasa Ambon. Francisca's father came around to her new husband soon enough and gave them his blessing. More importantly for them, they both established themselves quickly as productive members of a brand new society. Upon returning to a new, independent Indonesia, Francisca started working as a librarian, a dream job, because she could be surrounded once more by books. It wasn't hard for her to land a position. The new republic was starving for qualified workers and was still relying on Dutch librarians to work alongside her. As a result of intentional Dutch neglect, the Indonesian people were badly deprived of education. By the time the Dutch withdrew, only around 5% of the Indonesian population of 65 million could read and write. Francisca said, "I think this was one of the worst crimes of colonialism. After 3.5 centuries of Dutch occupation, we were left with almost no knowledge of our own people and our own culture." Meanwhile, Zane started working in journalism and got a job at a paper called Harian Rakyat, or The People's Daily. This was the newspaper run by the Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI. It was a great job for Zane to land, and Francisca was very happy for him. There was nothing strange about working for a communist paper at that time, as far as she was concerned. She knew he was close to the Communist Party, and probably a member, but none of it was a big deal. After the 1948 clash, the Communist Party had reorganized and integrated into the new nation. The PKI was one branch of a multi-party patriotic revolution. The PKI was part of Sukarno's New Indonesia. Because of his language skills, Zane was assigned an extremely interesting beat at the paper. He began writing about international affairs, translating stories from abroad for a local audience. And for someone concerned with Third World liberation and the fight against imperialism, to use the language his paper used, the early 1950s were an incredibly interesting time. U.S. troops were in Korea in a war few people had expected to break out. After the Japanese left the Korean Peninsula, which they had dominated even more brutally than they did Indonesia, the country was divided in two. During Japanese rule, what was left of the Korean Communist Party, Stalin had much of its leadership executed in the late 1930s, waged fierce guerrilla warfare against the occupiers across Korea and Manchuria until they were forced into exile in Siberia. One of these communists, Kim Il-sung, took over in the north in 1945. In the south, the occupying U.S. forces plucked up Syngman Rhee, a Christian and anti-communist who had lived in the U.S. for decades, and installed him as leader. His authoritarian government targeted leftists and massacred tens of thousands of people on Jeju, an island that had been controlled since the war by independent people's committees, using the threat of communism as justification. In 1950, war erupted at the dividing line. Northern communist troops rapidly pushed into Seoul, leading the United States to take to the UN to gather forces for a counterattack. For reasons that are unclear, Stalin instructed his ambassador to sit out the vote at the UN rather than protest, and the US easily won the vote. The US-UN troops pushed North Korea back to the original borders, but then proceeded north in an attempt to take the whole country. The Soviets offered little help. But to Washington's surprise, Mao's tired and ragged Red Army mobilized to help the Korean communists, largely because they felt they owed the Koreans a debt for the assistance Kim's insurgents had offered them against the Japanese in Manchuria. During the resulting 3-year stalemate, the U.S. dropped more than 600,000 tons of bombs on Korea, more than was used in the entire Pacific Theater in World War II, and poured 30,000 tons of napalm over the landscape. More than 80% of North Korea's buildings were destroyed, and the bombing campaign killed an estimated 1 million civilians. In Korea, the CIA boys also tried out some of the same tools they had unleashed in Eastern Europe. Thousands of recruited Korean and Chinese agents were dropped into the North during the war. Once again, the infiltration was a total failure. Later, classified CIA documents concluded that the operations were not only ineffective, but probably morally reprehensible in the number of lives lost. The CIA only found out later that all the secret information the agency gathered during the war had been manufactured by North Korean and Chinese security services. Once again, the CIA's well-funded covert operations came up short against actual battle-hardened communist soldiers dedicated to achieving victory. In Iran, however, where there was no such contingent, the young CIA found its first big win. Operation Ajax. At the end of 1952, Frank Wisner met with Monty Woodhouse, an English spy working in Tehran. The Brits had a problem and needed help. Since the end of World War II, they had been overseeing the formal deconstruction of much of their empire, but they certainly didn't expect that to mean they would lose control over the natural resources, too. In Iran, new Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh was overseeing the nationalization of oil production, and he had already caught MI6 trying to overthrow him for it. Mossadegh and the Iranians had a lot of reasons to resent the British. During their period of imperial glory, Iran suffered a famine that took the lives of 2 million people, and after World War II, the British set up an arrangement in which they took twice as much income from petroleum as Iran, while local oil workers lived in shanties without running water. When Mossadegh and Iran's elected parliament maneuvered around the Shah the British had put in place, London began looking for a way to claw back what it considered its own. The Americans, Wisner included, were wary of getting tied up in British imperial affairs, but their allies from across the pond appealed to their anti-communism. Mossadegh had legalized the well-organized communist-led Tudeh Party, along with all other political parties, and the Brits suggested to the Americans that perhaps the Tudeh could take over if they weren't careful, or even that the Soviets might invade. Changes at the White House at the beginning of 1953 were a very big help to the supporters of regime change. Newly elected Republican President Dwight Eisenhower appointed John Foster Dulles to serve as Secretary of State and tapped his younger brother, Allen Dulles, to lead the CIA. John Foster had two lifelong obsessions, according to historian James A. Bill: fighting communism and protecting the rights of multinational corporations. These came together in Iran. Concerns about communism and the availability of petroleum were interlocked. Together, they drove America to a policy of direct intervention, Bill wrote. The Dulles brothers and the CIA got the green light. Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, whom Wisner had hired in 1950, took charge of the mission, which they decided to call Operation Ajax. He had $1 million to spend in Iran as he pleased, a huge sum for the kind of help he wanted to buy. The CIA bribed every politician it could and looked for a general willing to take over and install the Shah as dictator. Agents paid street thugs, strongmen, and circus performers to riot in the streets. When CIA Station Chief Roger Goiron argued the U.S. was making a historic mistake by aligning itself with British colonialism, Allen Dulles recalled him to Washington. The CIA created pamphlets and posters proclaiming that Mossadegh was a communist, an enemy of Islam. They paid off journalists to write that he was a Jew. The CIA hired gangsters to pretend to be Tudeh Party members and attack a mosque. Two of Roosevelt's Iranian agents, who were handling some of the hired muscle, tried to turn down further work at one point, saying the risk was becoming too great, but Roosevelt convinced them by saying that if they refused, he'd kill them. For his part, the Shah was not convinced any of this was a good idea. He took off to Rome at one point, infuriating the Americans who wanted to make him king, but he returned to the palace in August 1953, rigged parliamentary elections, and served both the CIA and international oil companies well as ruler of the country. The Soviets did not rush to intervene in the country in which they were supposedly so powerful. In Washington, there were celebrations all around, and Kermit Roosevelt was declared a hero. Wisner had finally proved to the men upstairs that there was a real use for his gang of weirdos. In 1954, the CIA wrapped up another successful operation nearby in the Philippines. The left-wing Huk Rebellion that began under Japanese occupation continued after both the Japanese left and the U.S. officially handed over power to Filipinos. Anti-occupation Huk guerrillas were opposed to the new president, who had been an active collaborator with the Axis powers and the ongoing oligarchical control of the economy by hugely powerful feudal landowners. U.S. military advisor Edward Lansdale, who would later inspire the character of Colonel Edwin Barnum Hillendale in Burdick and Lederer's Ugly American, wrote in his diary that the Hucks believe in the rightness of what they're doing, even though some of the leaders are on the communist side. There is a bad situation needing reform. I suppose armed complaint is a natural enough thing. The U.S. helped the Philippines devise and implement a counterinsurgency operation and made considerable progress, including the use of more napalm. In a bit of bizarre psychological warfare, Lansdale also collaborated closely with Desmond Fitzgerald, a Wisner recruit at the CIA, to create a vampire. As part of a range of psychological operations alongside the war on the guerrillas, CIA agents spread the rumor that an Aswang, a blood-sucking ghoul of Filipino legend, was on the loose and destroying men with evil in their hearts. They then took a Huck rebel they had killed, poked two holes in his neck, drained him of his blood, and left him lying in the road. After years of conflict, the Hucks gave up, and the Philippines settled into right-leaning, pro-American stability that would last decades. With special privileges granted to U.S. corporations, the woeful condition of the Filipino people described by Lansdale remained entirely unchanged. The People's Daily reported on the events in Iran and the Philippines, of course. Even though Washington's real activities were secret at the time, Zane's newspaper and the global left-wing press were often closer to getting the story of Washington's interventions right than U.S. newspapers, which largely saw it as their duty to peddle the official line that Wisner and his team passed on to them. Zane, working late nights back in Jakarta every day, exhausted himself in this period, being one of a few people who could read and translate all the reports coming in. He was rarely at home with Francisca, as he was always rushing back to the newsroom working night shifts. Harry and Rakyat, or the People's Daily, was always a lean operation, 20 to 30 people working in downtown Jakarta at all hours. For a communist newspaper in a heady post-revolutionary environment, the People's Daily was a remarkably lighthearted read. There were cartoons poking fun at the bumbling Western imperialists, original works of fiction published every day, a children's section, and educational inserts with explanatory essays on global left-leaning figures like Albert Einstein and Charlie Chaplin. International news, the area that Zane oversaw, was a huge part of the coverage, and the paper paid special attention to events in the rest of the Third World. News from America. 1953 was the end of the Jakarta Axiom. Independent countries were no longer tolerated just because they had left-wing forces in check. With the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the new rule under Eisenhower was that neutral governments were potential enemies, and Washington could decide if and when an independent third-world nation was insufficiently anti-communist. Wiz and his boys, emboldened by the success in Tehran, turned their attention to Central America, where they would score the victory that would serve as a template for future covert interventions into the next decade. A decade before, the Guatemalans had a small revolution. A series of strikes led to the overthrow of Jorge Ubico, a pro-Nazi dictator who had worked hand-in-hand with the landed aristocracy and foreign corporations for two decades to keep peasants in a system of forced labor. In other words, slavery. The left, including the Guatemalan Communist Party, called the Partido Guatemalteco del Trabajo, or PGT, had long been involved organizing workers in opposition to him. The revolution arrived in 1944 when the United States under FDR was in an alliance with the Soviet Union and very busy fighting World War II. Perhaps for that reason, the new government didn't ring many alarm bells for U.S. politicians. From 1944 to 1951, popular school teacher Juan José Arévalo took control of the very young democracy in Central America's largest country. But it was the election of Jacobo Arbenz, who took power in 1951, that really turned heads up north. Arbenz was a middle-class soldier who became a large landowner himself, and to the extent that he ever held any radical ideas, they were probably due to the influence of his California-educated Salvadoran wife, Maria Villanova, a more complex and fascinating figure than he. A polyglot social campaigner shocked by inequality, she rejected Central American high society, read intensely and widely, and formed links with leftist figures from around Latin America. Arbenz accepted the small but well-organized PGT as a part of his ruling coalition, but Guatemala voted against the Soviet Union's actions at the UN, and the new president made it clear in his inaugural speech that his goal was to convert Guatemala with a predominantly feudal economy into a modern capitalist state. This was no small task. When his government passed a 1952 land reform, this effort ran up against very powerful interests. The government began to buy back large, unused land holdings and distribute them to indigenous people and peasants. Processes of these kind were seen by economists around the world as not only a way of benefiting regular people, but of putting the whole country to productive use and unleashing the forces of market enterprise. But the law stipulated that Guatemala would make payments based on the land's official value, and the United Fruit Company, a U.S. firm that basically controlled the country's economy for decades, had been criminally undervaluing its holdings to avoid paying taxes. The powerful company howled in protest. United Fruit was extremely well connected in the Eisenhower administration and started a public relations campaign denouncing Arbenz as a communist in the U.S., and brought U.S. journalists on press junkets, which were successful in getting deeply critical stories published in outlets like Time, U.S. News and World Report, and Newsweek. The CIA again asked Kermit Roosevelt to oversee operations. He refused this time, telling his superiors that future coups wouldn't work unless the people and the army in the country want what we want. Frank Wisner chose Tracy Barnes instead. Washington made three coup attempts, and it was the third one that worked. In November 1953, Eisenhower removed the ambassador in Guatemala City and sent in John Purifoy, who had been in Athens since 1950 and had thrown together a right-wing government favorable to both Washington and the Greek monarchy. Leftists there called him the Butcher of Greece. In Guatemala, the North Americans did their best to create a pretext for intervention. The CIA planted boxes of rifles marked with communist hammers and sickles so they could be discovered as proof of Soviet infiltration. When the Guatemalan military, unable to find any other suppliers, did actually buy some weapons that turned out to be worthless from Czechoslovakia, Wisner's boys were relieved. Now they had their excuse. Arbenz uncovered plans for the third coup attempt in January 1954 and had them published in the Guatemalan press. The CIA men were so confident that they kept going anyway, issuing denials to the U.S. press. They organized a tiny rebel force around General Carlos Castillo Armas, an unimpressive man despised even by the conservative officers in the Guatemalan military. They began broadcasting false reports on U.S.-controlled radio stations of a military rebellion marching toward victory and dropped bombs on Guatemala City. This was psychological warfare, not a real invasion. The ragtag group over the border in Honduras and El Salvador had no chance of actually entering and defeating the real military, and the bombs that U.S. pilots dropped on the capital became nicknamed sulfatos, or sulfate laxatives, because their job was not to do damage, but to make Arbenz and everyone around him so afraid they would fill their pants. Miguel Angel Albizures, 9 years old, heard the bombs explode near him, and the shock seared a feeling of fear deep into his brain. He was having breakfast before school in the capital at one of the public eateries set up by Arbenz when it started. He was terrified. Yes, so shocked, so afraid, he felt like he could shit himself, exactly as intended, and ran to take cover under the pews in the closest Catholic church. Arbenz, realizing that the U.S. was determined to oust him, began to contemplate giving in. His government frantically offered to give United Fruit what it wanted, but it was too late for concessions. The communists and a few others urged Arbenz not to hand over power. In vain, a 25-year-old Argentine doctor living in Guatemala City at the time, named Ernesto Che Guevara, volunteered to go to the front, then tried to organize civilian militias to defend the capital. Instead, the president resigned on June 27, 1954, and handed over power to Colonel Diaz, head of the armed forces. Diaz had met with Ambassador Purifoy and believed he would be an acceptable replacement to the United States. He told Arbenz he had an understanding with the North Americans and that if he took power, at least they could avoid losing the country to the hated Castillo Armas, which helped persuade the president to step down. That deal didn't last long. Just a few days after Diaz took power, CIA Station Chief John Doherty and his deputy, N.O. Hobbing, former Time Bureau Chief in Paris, sat him down. "Let me explain something to you," said Hobbing. "You made a big mistake when you took over the government." Hobbing paused, then made himself very clear. "Colonel, you're just not convenient for the requirements of American foreign policy." Diaz was shocked. He asked to hear it from Purifoy himself. According to Diaz, when Purifoy came over at 4 in the morning, he backed up Doherty and Hobbing. He also showed Diaz a long list of Guatemalans who would need to be shot immediately. But why? Diaz asked. Because they're communists, Purifoy responded. Castillo Armas, the U.S. favorite, took over. Slavery returned to Guatemala. In the first few months of his government, Castillo Armas established Anti-Communism Day and rounded up and executed between 3,000 and 5,000 supporters of Arbenz. Eisenhower was elated. Even though Wissner had been anxious throughout the operation, this was another triumph for his approach. After he and Barnes met with the president, they burst back into Barnes's living room in Georgetown and did a little scuffling dance. The People's Daily paid very close attention to the events in the small country half a world away. Day after day, the situation in Guatemala was at the top of the front page, and the headlines were clear and precise. America manjarán Guatemala. America threatens Guatemala. And then a long explanatory article. This is Guatemala, featuring a map of the faraway region, and then referring to American aggression. The U.S. press covered it differently. The New York Times referred to the coup plotters as rebels while calling the Arbenz government Reds or a communist threat and saying that the U.S. government was helping mediate peace talks rather than organizing the whole thing. Most historians today would quickly recognize that this small Indonesian communist newspaper reported the events more accurately than the New York Times. There is a reason for that. Sidney Grusin, an enterprising Times correspondent, was planning to launch an investigation of the rebel forces. Frank Wisner wanted him stopped. He asked his boss, Alan Dulles, to speak with the New York Times higher-ups, which he did. Believing he was performing a patriotic act, Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger ordered Grusin to stay away. There's also a reason that Zane and his colleagues paid so much attention to Guatemala. A front-page story in the People's Daily on June 26th said that what was happening in Guatemala threatens world peace and could threaten Indonesia as well. An international State Department document, now publicly available, should dispel the notion that Washington thought Guatemala was an immediate communist threat. According to Lewis J. Halley, in a note to the director of the policy planning staff, the risk was not that Guatemala would act aggressively. The risk was that Arbenz would provide an example that inspired his neighbors to copy him. The note reads, "The evidence indicates no present military danger to us at all. Although we read public references to the facts that Guatemala is 3 hours flying time from the oil fields of Texas and 2 hours flying time from the Panama Canal, we may console ourselves that Guatemala's capability for bombing either is nil." The recent shipment of arms makes no difference to this conclusion, nor would repeated shipments. The real risk, Halley said quite clearly, was that communist infection could spread through the example of independence of the U.S. that Guatemala might offer to nationalists throughout Latin America. It might spread through the example of nationalism and social reform. Finally, and above all, it might spread through the disposition the Latin Americans would have to identify themselves with little Guatemala if the issue should be drawn for them, as it is being drawn for them, not as that of their own security, but as a contest between David Guatemala and Uncle Sam Goliath. This latter, I think, is the danger we have most to fear and to guard against. The question of land reform was an exemplary and recurring case of do as I say, not as I do. When General MacArthur was running Japan immediately after World War II, he pushed through an ambitious land reform program, and U.S. authorities oversaw redistribution in South Korea in these years as well. In strategic U.S.-controlled nations, they saw the necessity of breaking up feudal land control in order to build dynamic capitalist economies. But when carried out by leftists or perceived geopolitical rivals, or when threatening U.S. economic interests, land reform was more often than not treated as communist infiltration or dangerous radicalism. The Dulles brothers had worked on Wall Street, and both had actually done work for the United Fruit Company. To this day, there is a debate as to whether or not the CIA engineered the coups in Iran and Guatemala for cynical economic reasons, to help business buddies and American capitalism more generally, or if the agency really felt threatened by communism. There can be more than one explanation. The leader of the PGT, Guatemala's Communist Party, said that they would have overthrown us even if we had grown no bananas. Wisner's discussions at home with his family indicated he really felt that the Iranian Tude and Guatemalan PGT were somehow a danger to his country. But the motivation didn't matter much to the millions of people reading about the events back in Asia, nor to the Latin Americans watching up close. Whatever their reasons, the United States established a reputation as a frequent and violent intruder into the affairs of independent nations. That young doctor, Che Guevara, believed he learned an important lesson in 1954. He came to the conclusion that Washington would never allow mild social reform, let alone democratic socialism, to flower in its backyard, and that any movement for change would have to be armed, disciplined, and prepared for imperialist aggression. Then, 26 years old, he wrote to his mother that Arbenz did not know how to rise to the occasion. The Guatemalan president, Che said, did not think to himself that a people in arms is an invincible power. He could have given arms to the people, but he did not want to, and now we see the result. Che took off to Mexico City and began to formulate a more radical revolutionary strategy based on what he had seen in Guatemala. Back in Indonesia, Francisca, though not following the news as closely as Zane, felt that the Indonesian revolution was far from complete. They had only been free from white colonialism for 5 years, she thought, and there was no guarantee the freedom would last. But she was usually busy working at the library and caring for their first daughter. Zane would come home late, and they would mostly sit around and talk about the books they were reading, mostly European literature, rather than discuss international news. Zane had enough of that at work, but she knew that their situation was fragile and that the Western powers were not inclined to simply cede freedom to the peoples of the Third World. The brutal French invasion in Vietnam was more proof of that. President Sukarno was always on the radio, putting his considerable rhetorical skills to use to drive home the point that Indonesians still had to fight. The way it looked from Indonesia was that in both Iran and Guatemala, nascent democratic movements had tried to assert new independence in the global economy, and the new Western power had reacted violently and crushed them back into the subservient role they had always played. Sukarno liked to call this neo-colonialism, or the enforced conditions of imperial control without formal rule. Thoroughly modern, he loved neologisms and acronyms, and later coined NECOLIM, that is, neo-colonialism, colonialism, and imperialism, to name the enemy he believed they all faced. In 1954, after Ho Chi Minh's surprisingly well-organized forces emerged victorious at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the French finally gave up in Vietnam. In Geneva, the U.S. was helping to hammer out the division of that country under the stipulation that a national referendum would take place to reunite its two halves by 1956. In Jakarta, Sukarno was about to meet one of the West's new representatives. Always sunny-faced and eager, Howard Palfrey Jones landed in Italy. President Sukarno. When smiling Jones arrived in Jakarta for the first time, he was enchanted. A teeming, steaming metropolis, he called it. He also recognized very quickly that America's supposed enemies operated here. He was sent to be chief of the economic aid mission and saw that in Independence Square, where Sukarno had made his famous 1945 proclamation, now across from the U.S. Chancery, every tree was plastered with a poster bearing the hammer and sickle. The same was true in front of his house, and when he got a chance to drive around the island of Java, he often found his car passing under arches of hammer and sickle streamers. Even though Sukarno, Indonesia's charismatic first president, was friendly with Washington and had always operated in varying degrees of opposition to the PKI, a minority party among many, the apparent boldness of the Communist Party, just advertising openly like that rather than hiding in the shadows, was worrying to the U.S. A few days after he got there, Pepper Martin, a senior foreign correspondent at U.S. News and World Report, gestured toward the communist symbols, turned to Jones, and said, "It looks as if it's all over but the shouting, doesn't it?" Jones would learn soon that it was far from over, and when he met Sukarno for the first time, he was blown away by just how complicated things were. Jones himself, like everyone else in the U.S. government, was an anti-communist and thought it was his job to fight that system. But he thought the major failure of U.S. diplomacy at the time was a persistent inability to understand the differences between third world nations and the nature of Asian nationalism. He believed that after World War II, The U.S. was too involved in the complexities of intimate relations with our allies of that war to hear the cry of peoples halfway around the world. He wrote, "We didn't understand and made little attempt to comprehend the political, economic, and social revolution that was sweeping Asia." Unlike many other Americans, Jones refused to dismiss the beliefs and practices of the locals, a priori, as backward. He paid close attention. Of course, he lived a very different life from the Indonesians. State Department officials lived in colonial mansions and had maids and cooks and drivers. Almost any U.S. citizen in the Third World would have been considered incredibly rich, even if they were not working for Uncle Sam. Once, one of the pools began to leak constantly. The local embassy staff knew what to do. They called a Haji, a Muslim who had made the pilgrimage to Mecca, who came and meditated. He told the Americans the premises had not been ritually consecrated. Jones recounted, without hesitation or skepticism, that they held a Slamatan ceremony, appeasing the surrounding spirits by planting a rooster head on each corner of the pool. It never leaked again. Jones, a Christian scientist who himself had watched his mother recover miraculously after bouts of prayer, never questioned there may be forces at work in Indonesia most Americans didn't fully comprehend. When interacting with other U.S. government officials, Jones would proudly correct them when they would mislabel Asians or their political affiliations. Most crucially, he thought Americans failed to understand what nationalism was in the context of emerging countries and its difference from communism. Nationalism in the Third World meant something very different from what it had meant in Germany a decade prior. It was not about race or religion or even borders. It was built in opposition to centuries of colonialism. Exasperated, Jones often stressed that to Americans this might look like an instinctive anti-Western disposition and that young nations might make early mistakes when forming a government. But wouldn't Americans feel the same way and demand the right to make their own mistakes? When Jones finally met President Sukarno, as he is called in Indonesian, he was deeply impressed. He wrote, "To meet him was like suddenly coming under a sun lamp. Such was the quality of his magnetism." He quickly noticed, he said, Sukarno's enormous brilliant brown eyes and a flashing smile that conveyed an all-embracing warmth. He would watch amazed as Sukarno spoke eloquently on the world, the flesh, and the devil, about movie stars and Malthus, Jean Jaurès and Jefferson, folklore and philosophy, then wolf down a huge meal and dance for hours. Even more impressive to Jones, who had lived a relatively comfortable life, was that this remarkable man, about the same age as Jones, learned to eat this way and became so steeped in knowledge while spending years behind bars for opposing Dutch colonial rule. Along the way, he had learned to speak in German, English, French, Arabic, and Japanese, in addition to Bahasa Indonesia, Javanese, Sundanese, Balinese, and Dutch. When Sukarno opened his mouth in any of these languages, the whole country stopped to listen, and Jones noticed that this had gone to his head. Sukarno told him once, after surviving yet another assassination attempt, "There is only one thing I can think of after yesterday. Allah must approve of what I am doing, otherwise I would long ago have been killed." Sukarno was born in 1901 in East Java. His mother was from Bali, and therefore Hindu, and his father, from an upper middle class of Javanese civil servants, was Muslim, like the vast majority of the island. On Java at the time, Muslims could be roughly divided into two categories. There were the Santri, the stricter Orthodox Muslims, more influenced by Arab religious culture. Then there were the Abangan, whose Islam existed on top of a deep well of mystical and animistic Javanese traditions. Sukarno grew up in the latter tradition. From an early age, he was well steeped in the wisdom of the Wayang, the all-night shadow puppet shows that function here in the same kind of way that epic poetry functioned in classical Greece. Though not from the elite, Sukarno was able to study in good colonial schools. Officially, he studied architecture, but on his own, he studied political philosophy. He began to move in Indonesian nationalist circles, which welcomed a broad range of anti-colonial schools of thought. Sarekat Islam, the Islamic Union, was the central nationalist organization at the time. It had conservative Islamic thinkers, as well as many who were loyal to the Communist Party. Then called the Indies Communist Party, the party had often disobeyed directions from Moscow when its leaders saw fit, and saw Muslim Unity as a revolutionary anti-colonial force. There were committed Muslim communists who wanted to create an egalitarian community, inspired to varying degrees by both Marx and the Quran, but felt that foreign infidels were holding them back. And for almost everyone in the country, socialism, by definition, implied opposition to foreign domination and support for an independent Indonesia. This brought Indonesians together. At one December 24th PKI convention at Sarakat Islam headquarters, they decorated the walls with red and green for Christmas Eve and dyed a hammer and sickle design in traditional Javanese batik style. Sukarno, by nature, was a syncretist, always more interested in mixing and matching and inclusion than shrill ideological disputes. In 1926, he penned an article titled Nationalism, Islam, and Marxism, in which he asked, "Can these three spirits work together in the colonial situation to become one great spirit, the spirit of unity?" The natural answer for him was yes. Capitalism, he argued, was the enemy of both Islam and Marxism, and he called upon adherents of Marxism, which he said was no unchanging dogma, but rather a dynamic force that adapted to different needs and different situations, to struggle alongside Muslims and nationalists. The next year, he founded the Indonesian Nationalist Party, PNI, which sat in the middle of the currents struggling against Dutch imperial rule, with the communists to his left and the Muslim groups to his right. Sukarno's natural predilection toward inclusion was extremely well-suited to the historical moment. Indonesia is an archipelago whose islands sprawl across 2 million square miles of sea and are home to hundreds of distinct nationalities speaking more than 700 languages. Nothing brought them together other than the artificial boundaries imposed by a racist foreign power. The young nation needed a shared sense of identity more than anything else. Sukarno was the prophet of that identity. In 1945, he provided an ingenious, impassioned basis for what it meant to be Indonesian when he put forward the Pancasila, or five principles. They were and remain belief in God, justice and civilization, Indonesian unity, democracy, and social justice. In practice, they combine the broad affirmation of religion that would likely mean Islam, Hinduism, Christianity, or Buddhism, revolutionary independence, and social democracy. They certainly didn't exclude the communists either, since the vast majority of them were Abangan Muslims like Sukarno or Balinese Hindus like his mother. Even if a tiny minority of high-level communists might have been without religion, they were happy enough to sign off on Pancasila within a few years. Later, the chairman of the PKI would justify this by offering a very novel spin on Marxism, saying that, within Indonesia, widespread belief in one God was an objective fact, and that communists, as materialists, must accept this objective fact. The Republic of Indonesia adopted a national slogan, Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, meaning unity and diversity in Old Javanese, the language spoken by the largest number of people, most of whom live in the middle of that central island. Pancasila, or Pancasila, is itself derived from Sanskrit, which was used in the pre-Islam days across the Nusantara archipelago when much of the islands were strongly influenced by cultural and religious elements originating on the Indian subcontinent. Indonesia itself simply means Indies Islands and is derived, like the name India, from the Indus River. It was under Sukarno's watch that the young country chose to make Bahasa Indonesia the official Indonesian language. A leader of less wisdom might have been inclined to make his native Javanese into the official tongue, but this is a hard language to learn and easily would have been seen as a kind of chauvinistic or even colonial imposition from the strongest island. Instead, Indonesia picked an easy, seemingly neutral language, and most of the country learned it within a generation or two. This was a significant achievement. Nearby countries in Southeast Asia still have not established truly national languages. Sukarno was a left-leaning third-world nationalist, and he was more of a visionary than a nuts-and-bolts administrator, as Howard Jones and the rest of the Americans would learn soon enough. True to his conciliatory nature, he was committed to maintaining a friendship with both the United States and Moscow, and he certainly was not trying to aggravate the leadership in Washington. Jones struck up a kind of friendship with Sukarno, despite the fact that many of his American colleagues thought they were losing Indonesia to communism. Indeed, he surprised many of the locals, including those on the more radical left, by simply calling them up for a chat. By now, the left automatically viewed the U.S. with suspicion. The days of Ho Chi Minh's overtures to Washington were over. Jones quickly came to the conclusion that in order to be effective, the aid programs he was managing could not in any way appear to be paternalistic or offend Indonesians' fierce pride in their independence. As for the point of that aid in the first place, he was quite open with the Indonesians. Washington didn't want Indonesia to enter the communist bloc. Sukarno was unquestionably president, but ruling required constant maneuvering within an unwieldy parliamentary system. He led a coalition government, and though the PKI supported the arrangement, there were several other parties that were much more influential, and the PKI had no representatives in his cabinet. As was his wont, Jones continued to correct other American officials who didn't comprehend Asia on its own terms. He understood when the Indonesian president told him, "I am a nationalist, but no communist." Smiling Jones was proud and dismayed that he was the one American who was convinced Sukarno was not a communist. As leader of such a large third world country, Sukarno was relatively well known back in Washington. But a year after Jones landed, Sukarno would put on an event that would launch him onto the global stage and change the meaning of the Indonesian Revolution forever. Bandung. That term, Third World, was born in 1951 in France, but it really only came into its own in 1955 in Indonesia. As historian Christopher J. Lee has written, it was the Conferencia Asia-Africa, held in Bandung in April, that really solidified the idea of the Third World. This remarkable gathering brought the peoples of the colonized world into a movement, one that was opposed to European imperialism and independent from the power of the U.S. and the Soviet Union. It didn't happen automatically. It was the result of concerted efforts by a few of the world's new leaders. In 1954, Indonesia got together with Burma, Myanmar, Ceylon, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and India, led by Jawaharlal Nehru, the same leader who gave the Kennedy brothers a lecture over dinner. They formed the Colombo Group, named after the Sri Lankan capital, where they met and began planning a bigger meeting. Indonesia's prime minister initially proposed a 1955 conference as a response to the founding of SEATO, the U.S.-sponsored copy of NATO in Southeast Asia. But the invitation list soon expanded rapidly as Nehru invited China, this necessarily excluded Taiwan, while apartheid South Africa and both Koreas, technically still at war, as well as Israel, whose presence might have upset Arab nations, weren't invited. The people who came together at the Bandung Afro-Asian Conference represented about half the United Nations and 1.5 billion of the world's 2.8 billion people. As Sukarno declared in his opening speech, delivered in bursts of accented but perfect English, it was the first intercontinental conference of colored peoples in the history of mankind. Some of the countries there had recently achieved independence, while others were still fighting for it. Brazil, the largest country in Latin America, attended as a friendly observer from outside Asia and Africa. The very existence of the conference elevated Sukarno and Nehru to the status of global leaders. It was also a catapult to worldwide relevance for Gamal Abdel Nasser, who had taken over in Egypt, the world's largest Arab country, just 3 years earlier. Like Nehru, Nasser was secular and left-leaning and insisted on his right to make alliances with every country, including the Soviet Union. By attending, Mao's foreign minister, Zhou Enlai, sought to legitimate the Communist People's Republic of China among its neighbors and take the side of the Third World. The content of the meeting led to a flowering of global organizations, some of which are active to this day. They were inspired by the spirit of Bandung, which Sukarno put forward very clearly in the rest of that powerful opening speech. We are gathered here today as a result of sacrifices, sacrifices made by our forefathers and by the people of our own and younger generations. For me, this hall is filled not only by the leaders of the nations of Asia and Africa, it also contains within its walls the undying, the indomitable, the invincible spirit of those who went before us. Their struggle and sacrifice paved the way for this meeting of the highest representatives of independent and sovereign nations from two of the biggest continents of the globe. All of us, I am certain, are united by more important things than those which superficially divide us. We are united, for instance, by a common detestation of colonialism in whatever form it appears. We are united by a common detestation of racialism, and we are united by a common determination to preserve and stabilize peace in the world. Sukarno wore a tailored white suit, glasses, and a small pitchy hat, and as he spoke, world leaders sitting around the small chambers clapped and leaned in to take in more. He had their attention as he turned his legendary rhetorical skills against Western imperialism. How is it possible to be disinterested about colonialism? For us, colonialism is not something far and distant. We have known it in all its ruthlessness. We have seen the immense human wastage it causes, the poverty it causes, and the heritage it leaves behind when eventually, and reluctantly, it is driven out by the inevitable march of history. My people and the peoples of many nations of Asia and Africa know these things, for we have experienced them. Yes, some parts of our nations are not yet free. That is why all of us cannot yet feel that journey's end has been reached. No people can feel themselves free so long as part of their motherland is unfree. Like peace, freedom is indivisible. There is no such thing as being half free, as there is no such thing as being half alive. Almost everyone in the room knew exactly what he meant. The people in that room that day would spend the rest of their lives describing the energy he had summoned in the crowd. He went on, "And I beg of you, do not think of colonialism only in the classic form which we of Indonesia and our brothers in different parts of Asia and Africa knew. Colonialism has also its modern dress in the form of economic control, intellectual control, actual physical control by a small but alien community within a nation. It is a skillful and determined enemy, and it appears in many guises. It does not give up its loot easily. Wherever, whenever, and however it appears, colonialism is an evil thing, and one which must be eradicated from the earth." Sukarno and the organizers had gone to great trouble to avoid antagonizing or frightening the most powerful country on earth with their openly anti-imperialist rhetoric. So they scoured their American history books and asked the Americans they knew, looking for a way to connect the date of the conference to the United States. They found one. The president continued, "The battle against colonialism has been a long one, and you know that today is a famous anniversary in that battle? On the 18th day of April, 1775, just 180 days ago, Paul Revere rode at midnight through the New England countryside, warning of the approach of British troops and of the opening of the American War of Independence, the first successful anti-colonial war in history. About this midnight ride, the poet Longfellow wrote, "A cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. Yes, it shall echo forevermore." As Howard Jones understood, the Bandung Conference put forward an entirely different type of nationalism from the type that existed in Europe. For leaders like Sukarno and Nehru, the idea of the nation was not based on race or language. It indeed could not be in territories as diverse as theirs, but is constructed by the anti-colonial struggle and the drive for social justice. With Bandung, the Third World could be united by its own common purposes, such as anti-racism and economic sovereignty, Sukarno believed. They could also come together and organize collectively for better terms within the global economic system, forcing rich countries to lower their tariffs on Third World goods, while the newly independent countries could use tariffs to foster their own development. After centuries of exploitation, these nations were far, far behind the rich world and were going to force that to change. There were 29 countries officially participating, plus states attending as observers. Both Vietnamese states took part because at this point they were still officially in peaceful coexistence until the 1956 referendum to reunite them. Cambodia's Norodom Sihanouk, like Sukarno, a strong supporter of independence from both Washington and Moscow, was there. The Syrian Republic, Libya, Iran, now under the Shah, and Iraq, still a kingdom, sent representatives, and Pakistani Prime Minister Muhammad Ali came along. Mamoulou Doukouli took a seat for Liberia, the country founded by former American slaves in the 19th century. Sukarno himself often linked the anti-colonial struggle to the fight against global capitalism, but the Bandung Conference was also a small blow to his supporters in the PKI, since Indonesia's Communist Party favored a direct alliance with the Soviet Union. Because of his language skills, Francisca's husband, Zain, was one of the Indonesian journalists lucky enough to cover the conference. He wrote it up for the People's Daily, which showered praise on the event despite this small slight. "Long live the friendship and cooperation between the peoples of Africa and Asia," the paper exclaimed on opening day, featuring a cover illustration of a man, his muscular frame held together by the flags of the Third World, turning the wheel of history. The next day, after Sukarno's opening speech, the People's Daily printed caricatures of figures representing Britain, the USA, the Netherlands, and France in a daze, suffering from a bad headache with a slightly forced little pun underneath. The Afro-Asian AA conference, Zane's paper joked, made the imperialist powers desperate for aspirin aspro, AA, because watching the unity of the independent young nations made their heads pound. From the United States, the keenest observer of the conference was Richard Wright, the black novelist and journalist. The former communist and author of Native Son wrote an entire book on his experience there, which went on to influence much anti-colonial and anti-racist thought. Once he found out about a meeting of almost all of the human race living in the main geopolitical center of gravity of the Earth, a conference of the despised, the insulted, the hurt, the dispossessed, in short, the underdogs of the human race, he wrote, he had to go and document it. Before leaving for Bandung, Wright spoke to North Americans and Europeans aghast at the idea of the conference, certain that a meeting of those nations could only amount to racism in reverse, hatred of whites inspired by the communists, or a global anti-white alliance. Even Wright himself was skeptical of the Bandung mission until he saw the legacy of colonialism and heard the speeches. He realized quickly that locals would speak to him entirely differently when there were no white people in the room. Wright met an Indonesian who had worked as an engineer for 3 months in New York, but barely left his apartment. He was too afraid of racist confrontations on the street. Then Wright came across a 1949 book designed to teach Indonesian to colonial officials and tourists, except it didn't contain any words allowing conversation. It was mostly a list of orders, all punctuated with exclamation marks. "Gardener, sweep the garden. That broom is broken. Make a new broom. Here are the dirty clothes." And then, in a section called "Hold the Thief," "All the silver is gone. The drawers of the sideboard are empty." Wright also realized just how little anti-communism there was in Asia compared to his native United States. Even the head of Masyumi, the Muslim party receiving CIA funding, told him the West's predominant fear of communism made trusting first world leaders difficult. "We shall always have our misgivings about the real aims of the West, of which we have had good reasons to be suspicious in our past history," the Masyumi leader said. No real success can be expected from a cooperation based on such weak grounds, meaning a partnership based purely on Washington's desire to find anybody to oppose the communists. Not everything went smoothly at Bandung. The Cold War hung over the conference, and not everyone could agree on how to mark themselves out from the major powers. Nehru, for example, resisted attempts by Western-oriented third-world states, such as Iraq, Iran, and Turkey, to condemn Soviet movements in Asia as colonialism. The delegates failed to come to an agreement as to how they could practically support territories still under colonial domination. In the end, they came up with 10 basic principles that would come to govern relations between third world states. 1. Respect for human rights and the United Nations Charter. 2. Respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of all nations. 3. Recognition of the equality of all races and the equality of all nations, large and small. 4. Non-intervention, abstention from interference in the internal affairs of another country. 5. Respect for the right of each nation to defend itself. 6. Abstention from the use of collective defense to serve the particular interests of any of the big powers, and abstention from exerting pressure on other countries. 7. Refraining from acts or threats of aggression against any country. 8. Settlement of all international disputes by peaceful means. 9. Promotion of mutual interests and cooperation. 10. Respect for justice and international obligations. Most famously, the Bandung Conference provided the structure that would grow into the global non-aligned movement, which was founded in 1961 in Belgrade. But in Asia and Africa, Bandung led to changes that were felt immediately. Collectives, communications networks, and international organizations sprung into existence. Leaders began to broadcast radio messages throughout the two continents, carrying the message of the spirit of Bandung to peoples still struggling against colonialism. Most notably, Nasser pointed his Radio Cairo broadcasts south toward sub-Saharan and East Africa with this message. In the Congo, people began listening to La Voix de l'Afrique from Egypt and All India Radio, which featured broadcasts in Swahili as a man named Patrice Lumumba was beginning to form the Mouvement National Congolais, a very spirit of Bandung independence movement that rejected ethnic divisions and sought to build the Congolese nation out of anti-colonial struggle. In 1958, the first Asian-African Conference on Women was held in Colombo and launched a transnational Third World feminist movement. For the 1961 Cairo Women's Conference, Egyptian organizer Bahia Karam wrote in her introduction to the proceedings, "For the first time in modern history, feminine history that is, that such a gathering of Afro-Asian women has taken place, it was indeed a great pleasure, an encouragement to meet delegates from countries in Africa which the imperialists had never before allowed to leave the boundaries of their land." The press in Egypt, for example, began to focus on the lives of women from around the Third World, including Indonesia, discussing the ties of sisterhood and solidarity between the women of Africa and Asia. And the Bandung Conference countries would go on to found the Afro-Asian Journalist Association, an attempt by people from the Third World to cover the Third World without relying on white men, usually sent from rich countries to work as foreign correspondents who had been telling their stories for decades, if not centuries. Within Indonesia, Sukarno had cemented himself in the minds of the people as the leader of a new kind of revolution. Francisca, absolutely inspired, would be able to recite parts of Sukarno's opening speech at Bandung by heart long afterward. In Washington, the attitude was very different. The response was racist condescension. State Department officials called the meeting the Darktown Strutters Ball. But to Eisenhower, Wisner, and the Dulles brothers, Sukarno's behavior was no joke. For them, by now, neutralism itself was an offense. Anyone who wasn't actively against the Soviet Union must be against the United States, no matter how loudly he praised Paul Revere. Now a senator, John F. Kennedy made his opposition to this approach very public in a set of speeches given in the years after Bandung. In a speech harshly criticizing the French for attempting to hold on to Algeria by force, he said that the single most important test of American foreign policy today is how we meet the challenge of imperialism, what we do to further man's desire to be free. On this test, more than any other, this nation shall be critically judged by the uncommitted millions in Asia and Africa and anxiously watched by the still hopeful lovers of freedom behind the Iron Curtain. JFK's star was rising, and this kind of position was rare among U.S. politicians. President Sukarno noticed what he said, but Kennedy was in the opposition, and one more event in 1955 in Indonesia alarmed the anti-communists in power in Washington even more. The CIA spent $1 million trying to influence the parliamentary elections in September of that year. The agency's chosen partners, the Majumi, were solidly to the right of Sukarno. Nevertheless, Sukarno and his supporters did well. Even worse for the Americans, the PKI came in fourth place with 17% of the votes cast. It was the best performance in the history of the Indonesian Communist Party.